Welcome to Designed for More, brought to you by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Join Dr. Jennings, a renowned expert in psychiatry, neuroscience, and spiritual well-being, as he explores the connections between mind, body, spirit, and relationships.
Welcome to Designed for More, sponsored by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. I'm Dr. Tim Jennings, joined today by Daniel Rome, one of our therapists, and Chaplain James Johnson, our chief of chaplains here at the clinic. And we have a topic today that we have a question on that's going to lead us into that topic, and it's about human attachments. Let's read the question. In many circles of mental health and healing, the concept of attachment theory is highly praised and respected form of defining problems and attempts to heal. I'm not sure why, but something about it just doesn't quite sit well with me. Am I off, or is there a biblical reason to approach this with caution? Maybe I haven't studied it out enough, but it seems to place a high value on feelings one has and uses feelings as the basis of the healing. I am rather simple man in this field and maybe just gun-shy of something which at least one of the leading founders was an ardent student of the concepts of Dr. Freud. So that is our question. It's really focusing on the question of attachment and attachment theory, and whether it's something that is reasonable and healthy to use, whether is there a place for it? Is there maybe a way that it could be applied in ways that are not as adaptive or healthy or appropriate? Is it biblically sound, not biblically sound? A lot of questions about it. Have y'all heard of attachment theory?
Absolutely, yeah. So,
what kinds of things have you heard?
Yes, as a therapist, a lot of my colleagues and people that I know use attachment theory, and the way that they describe it is, the way that someone attaches to their primary caretaker at birth can determine the way that they attach to people later in life. So that can be either secure in themselves, or maybe they attach in an insecure way that causes conflict and instability in relationships.
So before we get into parsing out these terms, what they mean, function, any examples of, you know, an adult who... or the problem, what happens when just taking what you said,
yes,
insecure attachments versus secure attachments, what does that look like in a life as it progresses? Insecure attachments results in what kinds of things? Secure attachments results in what kinds of things?
Yeah, so secure attachment looks like a complete individual identity, an ability to connect with other people without being overly reliant on them for one's own well-being. Whereas an insecure attachment can go really a few different directions, either being completely avoidant and fearful of relationships or overly dependent and intertwined. And that's getting into some codependent dynamics as well.
So is there a third, though? I think there's a third.
There's a third that has a few different names. It's basically oscillating between the other two.
That's the one that I think is... So the avoidant person... actually doesn't seem to manifest in psychiatric circles very much. Not that they're not, but they tend not to. They tend to isolate.
Yeah.
And then the codependent one we see in a lot of relationships, codependency elements. Maybe we can process what that looks like. But the oscillator. Oscillation means you move, you know, it's like a waveform, up and down, up and down, up and down. So attachment, you know, and breaking of that power, or rapprochement in the way the psychiatric parlance goes, that you seek intimacy, are frightened by intimacy, and then do something to poison the relationship to cause distance where you feel safer, but then you're feeling isolated and alone, and that frightens you, so you do something to try to repair the relationship, but then it gets too intense again, so you then poison the relationship. So it's an oscillating relationship like this. That would be another manifestation of insecure attachment.
Yes.
Okay. So for Pastor, anything you want to add far?
I'm excited about this topic because, you know, coming from a primarily pastoral theological concept, when you describe it, I get tons of examples and ideas, but it's great to be able to put a name to what I've seen happen in the world, and especially in the church, where we get, I think, a lot of confusion between what is healthy for a human being to be versus what can lead to unhealth.
So let's unpack a lot of this, but for me, I'd like to give an object lesson, I think, that could help our lay audience understand healthy attachment, what it looks like, and why attachments are part of God's design, but how they can be misused and can cause injury and harm. And the term attachment is in the original theorists who developed attachment theory, Bowlby and others. The attachment was for the person in the, you might call it the dependent place, the child, the infant, the one who needs something from the adult. They're in an attached relationship where the adult has a bonded relationship. They're not described by the original theorists having attachment. So a mother is not described as having attachment to the infant. Mother is described as having a bond with the infant, where the infant is described as being attached. And so the attachment is a need-based experience, where the bond is not a need-based experience. That's a huge difference, mm-hmm. because the need-based experience, it reduces autonomy, makes one vulnerable. So the object lesson metaphor is the umbilical cord. A woman who's pregnant, the infant developing in her womb is attached via the umbilical cord. The mother is, some might say, is attached, but truly not. She is not drawing her sustenance from the infant. She is drawing her oxygen from the infant. She is not in that position where that attachment provides nutrients and life. Mm-hmm. The infant is in the attached position where without that umbilical cord, it can't survive. And so that's what attachment in the original theorists meant after birth, that the infant attaches to some adult caregiver, typically mother, but it could be any caregiver. The infant will attach.
Right.
And they will seek to attach because they need not just food, not just bathing and clothing and warmth and shelter. They need love, affection, attention, instruction, education. They need someone to pour into them the sustenance of a developing heart and mind. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
The adult is not considered attached. They're considered bonded.
Right.
Okay. So with that in mind, can we use that object lesson? And I'd like you to keep piping in here as well, somebody who doesn't have necessary training in that, and be processing, okay, what would you see as potential problems? Use the mother umbilical cord example, the godly designed attachment, to how that umbilical cord attachment could become a problem. How could it become a problem for the infant? Being attached to the mother, how could that attachment actually be a problem for the infant when it's actually necessary for their life? Could it become a problem for the infant?
If the source of the nutrients or the mother is ill or not able to provide.
So how about, so very literal, let's stick with the umbilical cord and we'll move it to the psychological emotional piece.
Yeah.
Mother does a lot of drugs while pregnant. That umbilical cord in God's design, which is necessary for their life, which should bring nurturing sustenance, it now is bringing toxins and poisons. Mm-hmm. So now that attachment is not bringing health, it's actually bringing harm. But they can't live without it, so they can't connect. They can't cut that attachment. They can't serve. So understand that this is a very powerful dynamic.
Yes.
The baby, the infant growing in the womb, is being harmed by the attachment they have, yet they cannot sever the attachment.
Right.
Is there a lesson there in early childhood development?
Absolutely.
Okay, let's unpack that. Don't just say, let's unpack it. Describe for that. Well, describe what are the toxins of an early childhood relationship and how a child will actually seek to hold on to the attachment rather than try to break it.
Yeah, well, I'll approach it from the direction of I've had a lot of people come to me with feelings of guilt about their attachment to a harmful parent. But what's important that I think we're touching on is that it's part of God's design is for us to get our nurturance from the parent. So a child can't help but attach. And so,
in fact, let's describe, Frederick the Great, King, Frederick, Emperor of Germany, Austria, many years ago, had this belief that the original language that Adam and Eve spoke in Eden was German. That's what he believed. And he had a theory, he could prove it, that it's the natural language of all humans to speak German. And so he ordered that foundlings that were, foundlings, infants that were abandoned and then foundlings, and raised in the orphanage, he ordered that a certain number of them were not to have any human contact, that that they would be raised by caregivers, cared for, that would use wooden instruments to change them, and they wouldn't be held, they wouldn't be cuddled, they wouldn't be talked to, they'd be fed through bottles, and their diapers would be changed through wooden hand instruments in between, and so forth. And his theory was that if no human influence happened, they would still grow up and speak German. And you know the outcome of the study?
Did they die?
All the infants died.
Oh.
They all died.
So
because they were being given food, they were being changed, they were kept in a warm environment. What they were not given was human contact. The point I'm making is that human life requires emotional attachment.
Yes.
Relational attachment. So the infant, once born, is to be put on the mother's breast, not just for the physical milk, the emotional milk, the love, the caressing, the tenderness. Now, we know with brain science, when that happens, that it helps develop the higher cortical circuits, which calm the brain's fear and anxiety circuits when they have an affectionate, attentive mother, neurobiologically. But then psychologically, they begin to form internal to themselves who they are, their value, their worth, security in the world, and all the elements of a healthy identity and individuality is formed out of that attachment. So they're receiving emotional and psychological nurturance from a healthy relationship with mother.
Right.
So I point that out so that we look at the, again, very concrete and literal, mother, umbilical cord, infant providing oxygen, blood, nutrients. But if you poison that attachment and flow, you know, fentanyl or cocaine or alcohol or nicotine and tobacco, whatever, then you will actually begin poisoning. And depending on how much of that you do, you will alter and change the development of it and hurt them and harm them. But because if you cut that umbilical cord in the womb to prevent the toxins from flowing in, you kill the infant.
Yeah.
So there is no cutting. And so the point I'm making with this study is to try and cut the attachment to the dysfunctional person without providing another attachment that's healthy would result in their death anyway. So the infant cannot cut that dysfunctional tie. It won't work. They have to have an attachment.
Yes, absolutely.
And, you know, I guess this is where we get to the point, at what point is it healthy to start making these? I mean, how do you, as you start, how does a person recognize these things?
So we want to... So have a conversation then. I've given the big landscape. We recognize on a physical level toxins and poisons, and the infant can't cut the tie.
Yeah.
Okay, and now what are the types of toxins that come through the unhealthy emotional attachments? What are the things that will feed into the developing heart and mind from an unhealthy parent?
Yeah.
Can we describe some of those?
Yeah. Well, it's the parent's responsibility to teach the kid who they are. And so one of the biggest things that I see is lies about who the kid is. So you are bad. You are, you know, specifically speaking identity into the child that's contradictory to how God created them. And then these lies get really internalized, and then the child will carry them with them throughout their life.
So I think that's a really good point. And I think let's keep that on our list.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the way my mind kind of works, though, I'm trying to progress developmentally.
Yes.
And what you said is absolutely true. And it's a huge piece.
Another one is staying,
But before we get to that speaking in,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that child's at least, 3 years old by the time that happens?
Yeah.
So does the toxin not start until they understand language, or can the toxin start before they even understand language?
Well, the toxin can definitely start if there's not a...
So we're talking about attachment theory here.
So I guess not meeting fundamental needs. So maybe inconsistency in feeding, inconsistency in physical connection.
Okay, yeah. Now we're getting there.
Yeah.
So unreliability in the parent is where the child is not attended to in a reasonable way.
Inconsistent way, yeah.
Reasonably consistent way. I say reasonably consistent because it's not every single time. It's the majority of, a mother might, you know, be so exhausted she oversleeps one feeding or something.
Right.
That's not going to cause any attachment issues.
Right.
But a pattern of inconsistency will.
Yeah.
And that neglect. neglect does not provide the experiential contact necessary for healthy attachments to form. Abuse. Mm-hmm. Abuse can happen before language.
Yeah.
How about this? What would you say would happen to a child who is provided physical contact with the mother or father, fed consistently, changed consistently, from an attitude of resentment and disdain? They are going to do this because they are good moral people, and they will not abandon their duties because they don't want sin crimes on their record in heaven. But they do not want this child.
Wow.
And so if you look at the actual care, always fed, always changed, always washed, and always hated. Would that have any impact on the child's attachments? Theoretically.
Yeah, absolutely.
What would happen? What do we understand? And then if so, what might those look like? And then what do we understand attachments to be? So the attachment is that connection. Let me rephrase the question. What would the disdain and hatred of the parent, would that be a toxin that somehow gets into the child's developing self because of the attachment, through the attachment?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, what would that do? What was the potential outcome of that? And am I just being, you know, making up hypotheticals, or is this happens?
Oh, this happens all the time. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, working in the school system, I observed a lot of parents that were having children for a variety of reasons, but it was the idea that it was something that either that they really didn't want the burden, but they had to keep the child because that was the quote unquote right thing to do in their mind. And, you know, these children were, you know, going to have this imprint on them of, I'm worthless, I'm not wanted, I'm not desirable.
Okay, so what gets in is it that a child born into this world has no worth and value? Is that truth?
No.
Or does a child born into this world have value?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And where's that value come from? From the love and affection of the parent? Is that where the value actually comes from?
No.
The worth comes from? Where's it come from?
They were created in God's image.
Ah, it's inherent in their
yes.
being.
Yes.
So their value and worth is not dependent on the parent's attitude. However,
it becomes internalized.
Yeah. Can an infant internalize value and worth on their own because they objectively have it as a being? Or does their ability to experience themselves as value and worth directly come from those early attachments and experiences?
Absolutely, it directly comes from those attachments, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so this. So when we talk about attachment theory is those bonds that allow the life experiences to flow into the child and the child's forming sense of self.
Yeah.
If they're dysfunctional relationships, then dysfunction, just like if the umbilical cord is with a dysfunctional drug addict mother, brings lots of poison into the child. Many people come into adulthood from relationships that they could not sever at that age. Now, once a child is born into the world from a mother who's a drug addict and they're actually out of the womb now, can we cut the literal umbilical cord? Yes, we can. And so there comes a place when we can cut those attachments, but not until there's a certain level of development and autonomy. And in fact, one of the dysfunctions that happens in our society, you mentioned it earlier, is people develop dependent relationships. And dependent relationships is they never cut umbilical cords.
Yeah.
They never cut emotional umbilical cords. They're constantly seeking others to flow nurturance into their heart and mind to sustain their sense of well-being.
Absolutely.
So any other examples you can give of toxins of a non-physical nature entering in through these early attachments? I gave the one of disdain and hate. We talked about neglect and abuse. Other types of what have you seen in your patients that have attachment issues? What have you seen?
I mean, I mentioned specific verbal lies about identity. So a parent directly teaching their child who they are. This is who you are. you are a burden, you are a problem. Parents actually do say those
things
to their children.
Your disappointment. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wish I'd have never had you.
Yeah, yeah.
I've had patients that the parents told them that.
Yeah. Another thing that I'm thinking of is, you know, the healthy design is for the mother to be feeding nurturance into the child. That's the direction, the outpouring of love. But what can happen is that can be perversed in the way that it becomes flipped, where the parent begins relying or trying to rely or pull from the child nurturance onto themselves.
No, that's huge.
Yeah.
A parent who seeks to get their needs met from the child, and the child becomes a caregiver of some way, sometimes physical, alcoholic parents whose kids end up cleaning them up and cleaning the house and preparing the meals because they're so strung out on drugs or alcohol that they can't do their, this is not an uncommon thing.
Yeah.
But also the parents who turn to the children to get their own worth and value because they're, you know, insecure in their own right, maybe in a dysfunctional relationship, being mistreated by their spouse, and thus they turn to the child to be comforted and valued.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And in those cases, it may appear like the child is getting their needs met. We talked about physical needs being met, but there's also the emotional.
So we can recognize there are lots of, so attachment theory then would be the theory of understanding how early childhood bonds, attachments, relationships help form their inner world, their sense of self, their capacities for trust. And I think this is the big one we haven't mentioned. I think the attachment thing that's true, it is a bond that God designed for healthy parenting to love, nurture, provide affection, give value. So the child, not through words only, cognitive, but much deeper on an experiential level, experience themselves as having value, experience themselves as being loved, experience the world as being predictable and reliable because they're predictable, reliable. And that helps build an internal world of well-being, reduces anxiety, reduces fear, and ultimately creates a foundation where they can trust. That's the deal.
Yep.
If people cannot trust, they cannot enter into healthy relationships. Mm-hmm. And if they cannot trust, chaplain, I'm about to say something potentially inflammatory. No. I want you, you talked earlier about not being in an extreme, but, and this may be over the line, it may be wrong, but shoot it down and pull me back in, get me back in the bounds, okay?
You got it.
But if people cannot trust, they cannot be saved.
That's right.
Mm. Is that wrong?
No, that's the root of faith is trust. When we look at any healthy relationship, it has to be built on the belief that that person is trustworthy. They will do what they say. They are going to be faithful, you know, as much as we can expect any human being to be. But we cannot move into a healthy relationship with God if we don't know how to actually trust in a healthy way.
So isn't that, as you say, the root of salvation is a person comes to a real place where they trust God with their lives?
That's right.
They trust him. Mm-hmm. And if they actually can't trust, then they can't ever open their heart. Mm. And so I see the big problem that attachment theory has helped us identify are people who've had dysfunctional early childhood experiences that harmed both their sense of self and their capacity for trust.
Right.
They have almost always a warped sense of self. They don't know who they are. They have insecurities. They have a longing of the heart, but they have been hurt. They've been burned. They've been ridiculed. They've been put down. They've been abandoned. Life's unpredictable. Life's unreliable. And so it's scary. It's frightening. So fear goes up. And when people get fearful, they get self-protective. So they will end up with isolation.
Yeah.
The avoidance.
Yeah.
Don't make bonds. Don't open yourself up to get hurt again. It's safer not to. That's one defense against that. Or they go down the trail of seeking constantly to be cared for by somebody, trying to get that need met, but they abase themselves in various ways. They don't form a healthy sense of self. They allow other people to exploit them. They become that codependent person, needy, 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 and lose a sense of individuality and just do what they're told.
Yep.
Or they go in that oscillating relationship where they desperately want it, but as they get closer to the point where they actually have to truly trust, it's terrifying, because if they trust, they can really get hurt again, and they don't want to get hurt again, so they poison it. They do something to cause conflict in the relationship. They distance, and they're only alone, and then they desperate, and so they oscillate.
Yeah.
Do we see these, and this, and so the issue here, so how do we help people like this? How do we, so first, understanding the pathology, diagnosis, understanding there's woundedness in heart and in mind. It's, there's some of it is belief-based, as you're saying. They actually believe things that are false.
Absolutely.
But I think this is a spiritual wound.
Yeah.
Hmm. I think this is a spiritual wound, not primarily psychological.
Interesting.
Psychological would be their beliefs that they form secondarily to the experiences that they had. But I think this is a spiritual wound. And what I mean by spirit, their animating energy, which was supposed to have experientially woven into them from that love bond, was you are loved. And there are people who love you enough that would sacrifice for you. And while there are threats in the world, there's also trustworthy people in the world. That's a spiritual experience. And they were to experience that early on with the consistent parenting. Mm. But instead, they didn't get it. So it inflamed the spirit of fear. What's it say in 2 Timothy 1:7? God did not give us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and a sound mind. Mm. The spirit of fear is our natural attitudinal animation. We are born fearful and insecure. And the child needs the healthy attachment to give healthy love and nurturance, affirmation, cuddling, caring, healthy discipline, accountability from a parent who is doing this for the best interest of the child consistently and reliably. That's a spiritual experience that then translates into a psychological experience of a developing identity of how the world works.
Yeah.
What do you think, Chaplain?
I see that played out for good and bad, you know, when we recognize relationships that if a person grows up in a healthy, nurturing, supportive home, their connection to meaning and purpose, their understanding of the world being, you know, balanced, right? Yet there, like you said very well, there are unsafe places, but there are safe ones too, and these are trustworthy people that I can rely on, and that gives me eventually the goal of autonomy.
Yeah, I agree, but the question is, it's a spiritual wound.
Right.
Yeah.
That leads to psychological wound.
Yep.
That then leads to broken relationships.
Yep.
How then, if the wound originates as a spiritual wound, then what would the solution look like?
Oh, sure, I misunderstood the question. We've got to experience God's perfect love.
Yeah, but how do we help people who already have formed a belief that they're unworthy, that they have no value, that they're no good, that people who present themselves as interested in them ultimately end up hurting and abandoning them, that they fear rejection, they have the fears and insecurities in their spirit so strong that if people got to know me, they wouldn't like me. So how do we help people like that?
We have to take them from the funhouse mirror that's distorted to the true mirror that shows them an accurate reflection of reality and who God is and who they are.
Okay, and how do we do that? And either one of you, how do we do that? We do that because it's the same solution, whether they're getting it in the chaplain's office or they're getting it in the therapist's office, the solution will be the same.
Well, I take them to the Word of God and say, this is truth, and we can trust what God says because it's not only supernatural revelation, but it is proven in the natural world as well to be trustworthy. And so, whose value and whose beliefs are the more trustworthy understanding?
So, as we have this conversation, let's be clear, because we may have listening audiences struggling with this.
Yeah.
That while the solution is going to be the same, it's going to have to be the experience of the reliable trustworthiness of God Himself.
Mm-hmm.
Getting a person to that point where they can experience it will actually approach from different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Some people might approach that initially cognitively. Thinking through the evidence and through maybe the laws of health, the laws of nature, the design laws, and they begin to see how predictable and reliable God's laws that He built into nature are, and they don't judge and they don't change and they can't be amended. And as they see those predictable laws at work, that helps them have greater confidence in the world and their own, you know, how God made things, and that builds a sense of confidence, trust. Okay. Some people may come that way. Some people may actually experience a good Christian friend or counselor who they disrobe. And I don't mean literally. I mean they disrobe. This is they disrobe their psychological defenses that they hide behind the masks that they wear in public, if you follow what I'm saying. And they open themselves up to actually be seen and known and bear their soul to their therapist or a potentially mature chaplain.
Right. Yeah.
And they're not rejected.
Yeah.
They actually experience that even though they've maybe lived a rough life and gone through some horrible things, maybe made some poor choices that they're ashamed of, that the person that they're dealing with, they experience the love of God from. That person sees them as a child of God who's wounded in need of healing, not a criminal or a valueless person who needs rejection and condemnation. So that experience, that's relational, but it's also spiritual, isn't it?
Absolutely. So if I'm understanding you right, you would say that the cure for unhealthy attachments and unhealthy self-worth and misunderstanding would be healthy relationships.
So healthy relationships can only exist with healthy people. So the insecure, broken person cannot actually have a healthy relationship until they heal their wounds. They can meet healthy people and from the healthy person start getting healthy nurturance, healthy boundaries, a healthy speaking of truth and love, healthy opportunities to engage. But until they deal with themselves, that relationship, even if it's a healthy person, still won't be a healthy relationship.
Mm. Yep.
So that, and I see that happen a lot with people who they mean well, they meet the person that's got this attachments, and that person starts to feed off of them and get their self-worth from this healthy person. And it can actually, if they don't have that health, they don't know how to put those boundaries, they can actually end up having their own inner struggles because here's this person I love very much, but they're just a drain on me because they're constantly seeking their validation from me.
And what happens is that empathic people in relationships with people with attachment issues with good hearts will often end up making the problem worse, and it's called colluding.
Okay.
They collude with the pathology by allowing the dependent person to depend on you rather than developing and healing their own inner person. And so the attachments that people form are as God designed, just like an umbilical cord.
Yep.
The umbilical cord in God's plan is a healthy attachment and is designed to bring healthy nurturance for the development of the fetus up until the point where they're born, and then it's God's intention that that attachment be cut.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And so emotional attachments then take the place of the umbilical attachment for the speaking into the child, all of these things we describe for their developing sense of self, until they grow to the point that normal human development happens between age 17 and 25, there's a developmental phase called separation individuation where attachment is cut.
Yes.
And we are no longer attached, needing my parents or someone else to speak into me for me to experience wholeness, well-being. I have gotten the nurturance, the development, the affirmation, the love, the perspective, all these things that have brought me to this point. Now I separate and form my own individuality, my own identity, my own personhood, and I can be separate and distinct emotionally, mentally from my parents, and we can disagree on something, and I don't collapse under condemnation if my parents think that I'm stupid because I believe this and they believe that. It's like, okay, persuade me why this is a better way to see things. I'm open for persuasion, evidence, and truth. But I have my own mind, my own individuality, my own capacity for thinking, and my own now only healthy long-term attachment where we constantly are getting sustenance and nurturance to maintain our well-being is our attachment to our Heavenly Father or Jesus Christ or the Holy Spirit because they're all in one.
That's big. That makes sense.
Yes.
And that is to transition. Mm-hmm. Some people will do it earlier than 17. But ultimately, the transition is our attachment is to our Heavenly Father.
Right.
So what do we do when, one of the things that I've seen with teenagers a lot, those teenage adolescent years, they're very heavily connected to media, to music, to movies, to the internet, things like that. And one of the themes that comes up a lot when it comes to relationships and these avenues of entertainment is I need someone to complete me, to make me whole.
So what you just threw out sparked in my mind an idea of how nefarious, and I might even say, innocuous nefarious people will take advantage of dysfunctional attachment. Gangs, an individual with no sense of connection, no sense of identity, no sense of peep, they find their identity in the gang. Yeah. Cult leaders, terrorist organizations with young men looking for identity, looking for attachment. Well, through that attachment will be validated. You're special. You've got a mission and so forth. And because they don't know who they are vulnerable to this. And then corporations, particularly certain entertainment elements of our society, a lot of people without healthy sense of self will find identity in their sports team, in their entertainment icon, their fantasy programming, you know, whether it's, you know, Star Wars or something else, Star Trek, and but they attach some sense of self to these external things that give their life some sense of validation and meaning. Mm-hmm. Some of it might be innocent and fairly innocuous. Some of it's not, depending. And healthy people might just enjoy a sports team. Other people, they actually live, breathe, and they don't know who they are without that team.
Yeah.
And we see that in the military a lot. You know, there are some people that come in and the military becomes part of their life, or they you know, use it as a tool to go to school or to get a skill and travel, things like that. But then there are those that they become, their identity is so enmeshed with that, that when they get out for whatever reason, whether it's injury, finishing up a contract, retirement, they don't know how to live outside of that atmosphere.
Yeah, and so what we described there are the attachment that never separated and individuated. And so immature people may come into the military, and the military acts as a family with parents, commanding officers, that set the rules, discipline the disobeying children, and set the structure, give the your monthly allowance, your paycheck. And if you operate inside, you don't have to actually, the military is a very structured environment. And if you operate with inside the structure, you can do very well. But if you never separate and individuate, then you may have this hard time. So it can be a place of healing for people who come from dysfunctional homes. As they come into the military, they find that they are valued, they are validated, they're given structure. And if they then internalize that and form their own identity and then learn to think for themselves, sometimes they can mature. Other times they don't.
Right. Mm-hmm. So what do we do when you know, how do we help people recognize that they have unhealthy attachments?
So Jesus said those who are well, he did not come for those who are well, but those who are sick. Mm. We can't help people who in their own mind do not recognize they have a problem. Mm. Yep. They have to first recognize there's something wrong. And typically it is the painful consequences of dysfunction that cause people to recognize something wrong. It's not their own dysphoria, their own emptiness, their own loneliness, their own broken relationships that cause them to recognize something's wrong. The very immature person will struggle to look inward and say, okay, what is it about me that this is my third alcoholic husband that I've married? Mm-hmm. Instead, they will continue to go, all these alcoholic losers are the problem. They won't actually say, well, yeah, but I've picked three alcoholic losers. Why would I find those people attractive, having had three of them in the past? Or, and you know this is true, people will marry an abusive spouse and marry another one, or get and date one and date another and date another. And they and some will actually go, okay, what's wrong with me that I keep dating these losers, these people who beat me up? Yeah. Others will not. They will only say, well, men are just a bunch of abusing losers. And they won't actually recognize that there's something in them that finds those types of people attractive.
Yep.
And so it's when we have a person that has come to the point that they recognize they're not happy, that we can then have the conversations and recognize that something's going on with them, if there's a pattern of dysfunction that keeps repeating, and we can help them heal that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, does that sometimes require them to, obviously, an abusive spouse, that would be understandable. They need to cut that relationship off. But let's say the parent was the cause, like we kind of mentioned in the beginning. How does a person who recognizes, wow, I developed an unhealthy attachment through the way I was brought up, but I love my parents, I love my family. What's the secret sauce to being in a healthy attachment in your own identity and still keeping those relationships?
So let's define words again.
Okay.
Yeah.
Attachment means... in the language we're using here, you're dependent in some way.
Okay.
So the infant is attached through the umbilical cord or the early bonds. But healthy development means we break those attachments, we cut them. And then we have bonded relationships, not attached relationships.
Okay, I appreciate the clarification.
Yes. So if they're in an attached one, you want to ask, is this attachment still healthy and necessary? Like the infant in the womb can't cut the umbilical cord. It's necessary, even if the mother's toxic. Yeah. Early childhood experiences, and this is one of the difficulties in dealing with abuse in childhood, is that, that you can remove a child from an abusive parent. If you can't help them form an attachment with someone else, you might stop the toxin, but you might cause more of a different nature of the problem.
So kind of like what we see sometimes in foster care.
Right. This is what the foster care problem is, that you're removing them out of the overt physical or sexual abuse. But, and this is why I said earlier, I'll come back and circle this. Kids who are in homes in which they're physically abused will almost always defend the abuser.
Yes.
Well, if you had a cognitive and conscious infant in a womb whose mother was doing drugs or alcohol, and someone said, oh, there's drugs and alcohol going through that umbilical cord, let's cut the umbilical cord. If the infant could do something, would they want to help you cut that umbilical cord or stop you?
They will stop you. Yeah.
Of course they would, even though it's toxic. And so when you understand that dynamic, I don't think our social service programs really understand the dynamic of what they're doing. We certainly have to intervene to help stop child abuse. At the same time, though, how do we mitigate the loss of the attachment relationship? Serial foster homes might be physically safe, but then we're back to that place of not getting the actual affirmation and affection and developing soul needs.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of spiritual injury, I think, that happens to these individuals because of the dysfunctional parenting that causes toxic stuff to go through the attachment relationship, and then social services coming in and cutting the attachment to protect them from the toxic stuff, but not resupplying an attached relationship.
Yep. Yeah. And something that I've seen is people then get stuck as they get older in that childlike mindset of waiting for someone to come and be the healthy parental source.
In early childhood and middle childhood, it requires experience, the experience of someone who will love and affirm them through difficult times. Later, after age 17 and the longer, all the way up to 25, as the prefrontal cortex develops, then through good therapy and truth applications, they can come to work through the past, can't change the past, and through internalized truth of who they are as revealed in God's word, and come to a point that they can reach out and with their own minds to God, and they can experience healing of their souls even without that childhood experiencing. But it requires a certain developmental level to be able to engage the hardware. The cognitions are not there to be able to think on that level. Before age 15, most, at the minimum, and it's often later, that people can't abstract think. They think very literally and concretely, and therefore it's hard for them to process. They only experience their injuries and wounds, and they only distrust and fear, and it's hard for them to really reprocess the wounds that happened in the past until their brains have developed a little bit higher level. And I think this is why, neurodevelopmentally, these capacities, why Jesus said, woe to those who harm the little children.
Yeah.
Because you harm the little children, you really create problems that can be healed, but it often takes a long time with a lot of effort.
And when you talk about that healing, and this may be a rabbit trail, but is grief on? I mean, like you see a person who comes to, they're 28 years old, they're going to therapy, they recognize, wow, a lot of the mess that I went through was because of the attachment, the unhealth in my family being raised up. To make peace with their past and move forward, is grief an element that you guys usually bring into the therapeutic process?
Yeah, absolutely, because like what I said a second ago about how people hold on to it. They're waiting for something to happen. Maybe they're blaming themselves because if they hold their parents accountable, then they have to recognize the depth of the wrong that was done to them. And I think grief is part of releasing that and choosing to mature.
So the grief, though, is often missed in the sense that they think they're grieving the parents they had.
Right.
They're not. You have to speak truth. Mm-hmm. What yep. they're grieving is the wish and the dream for different parents.
Yes.
They're if they were actually truthful, they are not actually grieving the loss of abusive, dysfunctional, neglectful parents.
Correct.
That's actually a relief to not have that constant negativity being spoken in or experienced in their life anymore. But the normal defense against that is to hold out an unconscious wish or longing for a loving, nurturing parent. And then the way that gets acted out in relationship is that the unconscious wish is acted out by the person, the child, seeking to do whatever they can to get the parent to finally be the good, loving parent. So they're yep. constantly in this codependent relationship in which they try to do something to finally merit and get the parent to validate, approve, and love them in some way. But the parents are broken. They're dysfunctional. They never do. And so there's oscillation of approachment, reproachment, and then yeah. they repeat that in other relationships. So there needs to be a grief. There needs to be acceptance of the truth of who they were. And then you grieve the fact that you didn't have loving, nurturing, supportive parents, and you're never going to have them. And yes. that's what they don't want to give up. They want to hold on to the dream that maybe one day I will, but they can't heal until they actually grieve the fact that they grieve the fact of the dream, the wish, not the reality, because the reality is not something to be held on to.
Yep, absolutely.
Well, anything else you guys want to say about attachment before we wind this down?
I just really want to reiterate that this is stuff that can be healed. I think a lot of people listening might relate to some of the experiences that we described. And I just really want people hearing to know that this is not something that has to be a permanent injury, a permanent wound, and that it really can be healed in relationship with God as possible.
So what I want to help have people understand is that attachments are designed by God mm-hmm. to be bonds through which, whether it's the physical umbilical cord or the emotional attachment, through which healthy nurturance, whether it's physical with the blood and nutrition, oxygen in the womb, or emotional, psychological, spiritual in the early childhood period, is to flow into the developing human being. These are the attachments. However, I want people to understand in God's design, the attachment is to be cut at some point as you form a healthy individuality and stand autonomously in your relationship with your creator. And yes. then you end up engaging in healthy bonded relationships. So the idea here is not we want to help people to have healthy attachment. We want to help people sever attachments and become autonomous. So thank you for joining us today. If you have questions, send those into questions@designformore.net, questions@designformore.net, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for joining us on Designed for More, brought to you by Come and Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcasts for more inspiring content.